The way I normally start my talks is by saying that as a longtime grassroots environmental activist, as a creature living in the crashing endgame of civilization, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss and have grown accustomed to carrying the daily weight of despair. And I've walked clear cuts that wrap around mountains and drop into valleys and climb ridges to fragment watershed after watershed. And I've sat silent near empty streams or near empty streams that 2 generations ago were lashed into whiteness by uncountable salmon coming home to spawn and die. And a few years ago I began to feel pretty apocalyptic, but I hesitated to use that word in part because of all those cartoons I've seen of crazy penitents carrying the end is near signs, and in part because of the power of the word itself, apocalypse. I didn't want to use that lightly. Then a friend and fellow activist, George Raffin, said to me, "So Derek, what's it going to take for you to finally use that word? Will it take the death of runs of salmon so large that people were afraid to put their boats in water for fear they'd capsize, so large that horses were afraid to get in the water, so large that you could hear them coming miles before you would see them? Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons so large they darken the sky for days at a time. Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of Eskimo curlews just as large. Maybe it'll take the turning of the sea off San Diego into a dead zone, the turning of the Gulf of Mexico into a dead zone. Maybe it'll take global warming. Maybe it'll take the ozone hole. Maybe it'll take dioxin in every mother's breast milk. Maybe it'll take flame retardant in every mother's breast milk. Maybe it'll take the collapse of phytoplankton populations in the ocean. Maybe it'll take the elimination of 90% of the large fish in the oceans. And, you know, give me a specific threshold, Derek, a specific point at which you finally use that word." The health of the land base will be the only measure by which we will be judged by those who come after. They're not going to care whether we were pacifists or violent. They're not going to care if we're nice people. They're not going to care if we're happy. They're not going to care if we read a lot of books. They're not going to care if we made a film document. They're not going to care if we wrote books. They're not going to care about any of that. They're going to care about the health of the land base, because I've gotten so many arguments with socialists and others who, you know, are striving for this great socialist industrial system. And it doesn't matter. You can have your groovy eco-village. You can have your socialist utopia. You can have your capitalist utopia. It doesn't matter if you don't have food to eat, if the food you eat is poison, and if the water's poison. Every stream in the United States is contaminated with carcinogens. Every stream. This is not radical environmentalists saying this. This is the USGS. I mean, it's amazing what we can do when we put our minds to it. We can poison every stream in the world. And if you don't have air to breathe, you know, what use is everything else? This is, everything comes from the land. And it's a measure of our stupidity that we even have to talk about this. I mean, I've heard it said that one of the signs of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. And so I'm going to list out a pattern here real quickly, and let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years. And that's when I think of, or when you think of, the plains and hillsides of Iraq as the first thing that you normally think of, cedar forests so thick that sunlight never touches the ground. I think for most of us that's not the case, but the first written myth of this culture is Gilgamesh cutting down those forests to make cities. But when we think about the Arabian Peninsula, is the first thing we think about oak forests? That was forested prior to the arrival of this culture. Then let's move a little bit west, and we've all heard of the cedars of Lebanon, you know, and they still have one on their flag. Let's go to North Africa, where the forests were cut down to make the, I believe it was the Phoenician navy, it might have been Egyptian. Greece was forested, Italy was forested. One of those dead Greek guys, might have been Aristotle, I'm not sure who it was complaining about the effects of deforestation on water quality. And I'm reasonably certain that those in power responded by saying that we need to study it a little bit longer before we can make any determination. I think one of the best lines I ever wrote was that forests precede us and deserts dog our heels. Pretty sure I wrote that. And it's not just forests, it's everything. This culture doesn't merely deforest, it it destroys all life. I mean, do you know why there are no penguins in the Northern Hemisphere? It's because they were eradicated. They're called great auk, A-U-K. The Portuguese called them penguins, which means the fat ones. And there were so many that when they were in Europe, they were eradicated in Europe a while ago, and then they were still in North America and the islands of the North Atlantic. And at one point early on, this Frenchman basically said that you could load every ship in France with the great ox just from one island and you wouldn't make a dent. And of course they did, and of course it did. I think the way to go with that, for me at least, is that I realized as I was writing the newest book, Endgame, that I'd been bashing civilization for probably, 10 years now, and I'd never defined it. I didn't know what I was talking about. And so I define it in that book as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. And that definition is defensible both linguistically and historically. Civilization comes from civitatis, which means state or city. And historically, that's pretty much where most people start civilization is the rise of cities. That's great, Derek, but what's a city? I've defined a city as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And what that means is the Talua, on whose land we are now, were not civilized because they didn't require the importation of resources. They didn't live in cities. They lived in camps, villages, and so on. And remember, the Talua lived here for 12,500 years at least. A couple of things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One is that your way of living can never be sustainable. Because if you require the importation of resources, what that means is you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. And as your city grows, you will denude an ever larger area. Because by definition, you're requiring the importation, which means it's not there. And once again, that means that systematically, that means that functionally, your way of life can never be sustainable. We can talk all we want, but it won't last. New York won't last, because New York City won't last because it requires the importation of resources. The other thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence, because if you require the importation of resources, what that means is that trade will never be sufficiently reliable, because if you require the importation of resources and you need a particular resource that you are going to try to trade the next village over for, but they won't give it to you, you'll take it because you require it. It's not some resource you want. It's not, trading shells for buffalo robes. Instead, you require it, which means we could all become just the most enlightened beings on the entire planet, and it wouldn't matter. The U.S. military would still have to be huge, because otherwise, how are we ever going to get our access to our oil that's under somebody else's land? And so that's on a functional level. That's why it's not redeemable on a functional level, which I think for current purposes is really, and we can talk psychologically and socially about why it is too, but I think for the current purposes, that's actually the most important reason, is because psychologically and socially are really important, but once again, it doesn't matter. You could have this huge transformation of the heart, and if you still require the importation of resources, what are you going to do about it? The entire culture is based on a rigidly defined, yet often unarticulated hierarchy, where violence done by those higher in the hierarchy to those lower is either transparent, it's invisible, or it's fully rationalized. And violence done by those lower on the hierarchy, those higher, is met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. So humans can systematically exploit everyone else, but it was news the other day because there's a deer down in Southern California who's gored one dog and attacked three others, a buck. And so they're either going to kill him or they already killed him. And of course you can't have that, because violence is only supposed to flow from humans and their allies to, you know, down to the natural world. It's never supposed to go back. Or there was a horrible movie last spring, Spring Break Shark Attack. It's like, I wish there was that many sharks left in the world. You know, we're all supposed to be so scared of sharks. But the ratio of human attacks on sharks to shark attacks on humans is about 20 million to 1. And the bears, there's a lot of bears around here. I see bears all the time, literally. My mom sees bears, a couple bears a day, actually. And I walk, often through the forest at night, and people go, oh my gosh, aren't you scared? No, not at all. There's about one person dies in North America every year from a bear attack. And I would contrast that with automobile accidents or automobile wrecks that kill, I think it's, 40,000 Americans every year? I mean, so the truth is, it's like when we walk through a parking lot, we should be assuming all the cars are gonna kill us. And on the other hand, you know, bears, statistically utterly insignificant. Gender relations within this culture are based on that. That, you know, I used to teach in a prison, and the first thing a guy thinks about when he thinks about going to prison is rape. And there's an interesting thing about the rate at which men are raped in prison, which is that it's lower than the rate at which women are raped in the culture at large. When it happens to a man, at least it's noticeable. When it happens to a woman, in many states, it's not even a crime if they're married. So a few years ago, I was on this panel with, I think, 8 or 9 people, one of whom was this really strong pacifist. And he kept, the panel was about organizing, but he kept bringing it back to pacifism anyway. And at one point, he said, violent schmilence, which was pretty much the level of his arguments. He said, violent schmilence, I wouldn't harm a single human being to save an entire run of salmon. And my response at the time was not really much better, which is I just said I would. But what I really wish I would have said is thank you very much for precisely articulating the problem, which is the belief that any individual human life is more important than the health of the land base. That is the problem. I mean, in a nutshell, that's it. Including mine. If I can get across one thing in my work, it would be that the culture is a culture of occupation, and the government is a government of occupation. Of course, all of my American Indian friends say, what the hell took you so long to figure this one out? And what does a government of occupation do? It moves in, takes resources, and doesn't care about communities. And if aliens came down from outer space, and they were systematically deforesting the planet, and they were vacuuming the oceans, and they were putting docks in every mother's breast milk, and they were giving people cancer, and they were causing all these other problems, but we did get tomatoes in January, then we would know exactly what to do. We would put on our camo outfits, we would grab our AK-47s, and we would start picking them off one by one. If it was Islamo-fascists who were putting in all these dams, if they were commie pinkos who were putting in all these dams, we would know what to do. But instead, because we pledged allegiance to the flag, then we identify with the system, and suddenly we get really, really stupid. If we were, it's like, and it's just absurd, the responses that we're supposed to do, that are supposed to be helpful. So what would partisans, Russian partisans in World War II, you know, what would they do if someone was, if the German military was putting in a road and they didn't want the road to go in there? What would they do? They would destroy the road. And if they were putting in a bridge that they didn't want, that was going to be useful to the Germans, what would they do? They would blow it up. And then if the Germans built it again, they would blow it up again. And if the Germans built it again, they would blow it up again. And what do? We file lawsuits. We hold signs. We hold candles. We pray. We send loving kindness. And it's just ridiculous. It's absurd. And it's because we identify. We buy into the system. And several years ago, I was riding in a car with a friend of mine, George Draffen, and I was just making conversation. I said, so George, if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be? And George was not in a very good mood and said, Derek, that's a really stupid question. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the truth is there's only one level of technology that's sustainable, and that's the Stone Age. And we'll be there again someday. The only question will be what's left of the world when we get there. And the reason for that, or the reason we can say that, is that any way of living that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. I mean, eventually you run out. I mean, that's so simple that it's embarrassing that we even have to talk about it. And likewise, any way of living that's based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources won't last, because if every year there are fewer salmon returned than the year before, eventually they'll be gone. If every year there are fewer passenger pigeons returned than the year before, eventually they'll be gone. That's just the way things work. I mean, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone, and the head of the National Marine Fisheries Service gave us his response: we have to ask what level of decline is reasonable or sustainable. First off, and this is going to be really picky about word usage, no decline is sustainable. He could say reduction. We have to ask what level of reduction is sustainable. But he should know better than to say what level of decline, because if you have decline, that means a slope downward, which means that by definition, it's not sustainable. And the next thing about that, the thing that makes it even more appalling, of course, is he's talking about a 90% decline, which is neither reasonable nor sustainable. Okay, so any way of living based on the use of non-renewable resources is not sustainable. Any way of living based on the use on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources is not sustainable. But I would go a step further and say that any way of living that's based on the use of resources is not sustainable. And the reason I say that is because salmon don't consider themselves resources, and trees don't consider themselves resources. They're salmon. They're trees. I remember when I was teaching, the first time I ever heard somebody say that her major was human resource management, I thought, oh my God, I've fallen into Nazi Germany. Because, and the reason this is important is because there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you'll treat them one way. If when I look at trees, I see trees, I'll treat them differently. And if when I look at this particular tree right here, I'll see this particular tree right here, I'll treat it differently still. And of course, this is the same all across the board. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I will treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'll treat them another way. And if when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. So my point with all that is, before the world can be destroyed in the physical sense, we have to destroy it emotionally and perceptually. The anthropologist Ruth Benedict did a study as to why some cultures are more peaceful than others and more secure. And what she found is, I mean, some cultures are, there's a lot more warfare, and the warfare is much more violent. There's more, women and children are treated poorly. There's a lot of insecurity. And other cultures where women and children are treated well, where there's less emphasis on warfare, and there's, where people are more secure. And what she found is one simple rule that separates those types of cultures. And it has to do with, you know, sort of right-wingers oftentimes suggest that humans are intrinsically selfish. And liberals oftentimes say, no, humans are fundamentally good and we all need to just, you know, give everybody a break. And the truth is that they're both wrong, or they're both right, doesn't matter. That humans are, we are both selfish and communal social creatures. And the good cultures recognize that, and they get rid of that dichotomy between altruism and selfishness by making the most selfish thing you can do is to help your community. And they do that through praise. So, and they have social rules whereby those who give the most to the community are those who are praised. And on the other hand, they disallow behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the community. So if you, if I were to go fishing and I were to catch a bunch of fish and I didn't share them with the community, I would be shamed. I would be, if I did it enough, I would be kicked out of the community. And on the other hand, if I catch these fish and I share them with the community, then I am praised. It's very, very simple. You don't, if on the other hand, in the cultures where everyone was insecure, behavior that benefited the individual at the expense of the whole was rewarded, is rewarded. And it all comes down to how culture handles wealth. If it handles it through what she called a siphon system, whereby wealth is constantly siphoned from rich to poor, everyone is secure, because I give away all the fish today, and tomorrow you give away all the berries, and the day after that you give away all the tofu, you know? And on the other hand, in a culture where they handle it through what she called, handle wealth through what she calls a funnel system, whereby wealth is constantly funneled from poor to rich, then everything is a competition, and everyone is insecure for obvious reasons. And we, of course, have an entire culture that's based on that funnel system. And so I guess those are the reasons why I think that the culture really is irredeemable. I mean, as long as the social reward system is set up, it's going to continue to reward this behavior. I mean, access to land is everything, because access to land means self-sufficiency. And so if the rich own the land, that means that the poor have to pay rent in order to exist. That's money being siphoned from the poor to the rich. I'm sorry, that's money being funneled from the poor to the rich. And if you're hungry and you want to eat and you have to go to the grocery store owned by the rich people, I mean, what would happen if you didn't pay rent? You know, eventually some guy with a gun is going to come and take you away. You can't sleep on this planet without paying a rich person. You can't eat. What happens if you go to a grocery store and you start to eat? You can't eat without paying a rich person. That's money always being siphoned. That's money always being funneled to the rich. And another part of this is that this culture from the beginning is based on, this is kind of big words, but it works, the privatization of profits and the externalization of costs. And that's another form of this funnel system working. And the cops, the police exist, and the military exists primarily as muscle for the rich to make sure that the poor don't step out of line. I mean, a great example of that is Humboldt County, one county south of here, has the highest per capita, second highest per capita rate of rape in California. And there were, I think 3 years ago is the year I know the statistics for, there were two rapists arrested. I don't know if either of them were indicted or anything. And they arrested at least 16 tree sitters that I know of. You know, we always think of, you know, the job of police to, you know, rescue kitties. I guess as firemen, we're supposed to rescue kitties from trees. But, you know, the cops are supposed to, you know, always be there to help us. But the truth is that that may be most of what they do, but the most important function is maintaining the social order. And what that means is putting down strikes, et cetera, et cetera. Which means supporting the rich. We can also talk about this in terms of abuse, that everything within an abusive family structure is set up to protect the abuser. Everything. And by the same token, everything within this culture is set up to protect the rich. That's what this culture is about, to deify them. I mean, the fact that you and I both know who Bill Gates is, and we don't know the name of a poor person who lives in that same town, that's really everything you need to know. He's valorized. Why is he valorized? Because he made a lot of money. That's supposed to be a good thing. That's a despicable thing. Because it comes at the expense of the community. Well, this culture specializes in toxic mimics. And that's where you take the form of something and pervert the content. So rape, for example, is a toxic mimic of sexuality. It has the form, but the content is different. And we could make a whole list of toxic mimics. And one of the toxic mimics here is this identification with the larger whole, that's been siphoned off to a different direction. I don't want to use the word siphon, though, because we were just using it elsewise. That's been shunted off to a different direction, this identification. So part of what we're supposed to do is identify with our larger community. But that really only works when things are mutual, when the rest of the community is serving you as well. I'm not going to include the land base, of course, and it should include the land base. But with civilization, we've been taught to identify with this larger whole that isn't us. I mean, a great example, the other day I was talking to a friend who said, wow, we lost a lot of refineries in Katrina, didn't we? And I said, I didn't know I had any refineries. Otherwise, I would probably be rich, you know? It's like, do I get the money from these or something? And Or I have another friend who called me a while back and said, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? And I looked around and it's like, I thought we were in Northern California. And he's like, no, Derek, how much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Iraq? I said, I got troops? That's great. Can I tell them to go blow up a dam for me or something? And it's like, this is why I only call you about once a month, Derek. And so I think we're taught early on to identify with the system. I think that's one reason why we identify with it. We're taught all the time, we're doing this. It's like, you know what? We're not doing this. We're not deforesting. I'm not deforesting. I'm not doing it. And I actually oppose the people who do it and the organizations, institutions who do it. The organizations, institutions which do it. There you go. There's a problem. Calling an organization a who and then calling a tree an it. I mean, that's another problem. That's one part of the problem. Another part of the problem is that we will... If your experience, not your philosophy, not your thinking, not your heart, not anything else, if your experience is that your food comes from the grocery store and that your water comes from a tap, you will defend to the death the system that brings those to you because your life depends on it. If, on the other hand, your experience is that your water comes from a stream, imagine that. People used to actually drink from streams. I mean, how quaint is that? And if your experience is that your water comes from a stream and that your food comes from a land base, you will defend to the death that stream and that land base because your life depends on it. But we've gotten messed up and mixed up in this system that where our lives actually depend on the system that is exploiting us. And another way to ask this is, why do so many victims of abuse stay with their abusers? Because they're identified with the system. And they've been taught since they were since early on that everything is about protecting that system. So it's the same. The system is abusing and destroying us. And we've been taught from very early on to identify with that system. Because if we identify with the system, then we're fighting us and it, as opposed to simply fighting it. And that's much more difficult because it's our identity. Because we identify more strongly as civilized than we do as living beings. I mean, that's one of the things I used to really wonder is, why did my father act the way he did? Why did my father, beat and rape us? And there's a bunch of reasons for that. One of them is that by being free and happy children, we reminded him of who he was before he had been abused by his parents, and he couldn't pay attention to that. So he had to stifle that.
Because to feel that, for him to look at that, would mean this upwelling of fever, of grief and rage at his dad, that he couldn't
both his parents.
That to come up.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Because he had identified with them long before. That's one of the things you can do is, this is sort of, fancy, politically correct speech, to say identify with the oppressor. But that's what happens, is when you feel really powerless, a lot of times you can then identify with the oppressor. And that's what he did. And once identity is there, it's really hard to break that. And so he would destroy us rather than go through that death that he needed to go through. One of the theses of my book, A Language Older Than Words, is that we as a culture are suffering from what Judith Herman would call complex post-traumatic stress disorder. PTSD is when you've been traumatized and you may have a response to triggers associated with that. So if a woman's raped in a certain make and model of car, she may then feel apprehensive when she sees that make and model of car. Or we've all heard the cliche of the guy, the Vietnam vet who then, every time a car backfires, he hits the ground. And Judith Herman talked about something called complex PTSD, which is what happens if you're not traumatized once or twice, but if you're actually in captivity for a long time, if you're held as prisoner, and she includes domestic violence. What happens if you're raised in a circumstance where you're a prisoner? And one of the things that happens is you become afraid of all relationships, and you have to control everything around you. And because everything could hurt you, which means I need to control it before it can. You forget that all You forget that mutual relationships are possible, and you begin to believe that all relationships are based upon hierarchy, because that was your experience. And you come to believe that all relationships are based on power. And, of course, when we look around, that's what we see. And my thesis was not that we merely had complex PTSD, but that we have an entire culture suffering from it, so we are too frightened to enter into a relationship with these trees, with all of our neighbors. And so we call them resources, those to be exploited. And so we set up that all of life is this hierarchy, and, you know, of course, violence flows down the hierarchy, etc., etc. Well, if you have to continue to live in a city, you end up pretty deeply wounded. Every time I go to a city, I end up, at the end of the day, I feel abraded because there's so many people and there's so many sharp corners, and you end up insane. John Livingston, who wrote The Fallacy of Wildlife Conservation, has this wonderful bit where he talks about how we're essentially living, how most of our ideology, or all of our ideology really, is hallucination. And one of the reasons that happens is because we're living in an echo chamber where all of the everything that we receive, everything we see, hear, smell, taste, feel, originates in or is mediated by humans and machines. And if you're in that sort of solitary confinement, you're going to start hallucinating, and you may end up believing strange things like the idea that humans are superior or separate from everything else, everyone else. Years ago, I interviewed Luis Rodriguez, who wrote Gang Days in L.A., La Vida Loca, which is about his time in a gang, and he got out through the literature revolution. And one of the things I asked him is, why do so many gang kids stand on street corners shooting mirror images of themselves? And why don't they at the very least shoot at capitalists? And he said that one of the reasons, of course, is because the cops set them against each other. Another reason is that these kids want to die. And the reason they want to die is because they're teenagers, and when you're a teenager, you're supposed to want to die, but that death is supposed to be metaphorical and spiritual. Your childhood has to die so you can become an adult. But nobody's told them it's metaphorical and spiritual, so they have this death urge that they then actualize in the physical world, as opposed to through ritual or through maturity. And I've often thought that it's similar, that this culture is so wretched, and so many people are so very, very unhappy, and they want this nightmare to end, and they don't recognize that the death that they want is a cultural death and is a spiritual and metaphorical death. And so, especially because within this culture, you know, the spirit is separated from the earth and from the flesh, and so, you know, you can't have this transformation that simply occurs in your body. And so they make lots of depleted uranium, and they kill the world in all physical reality as opposed to that spiritual transformation. And so I think that actually accounts for a lot of the passivity and a lot of the denial, and also a lot of the reason for the destruction. People talk a lot of times about hope, and two things about that. One is that first there's false hopes, and false hopes are incredibly harmful. I mean, does anybody really think that warehouses are going to stop deforesting because we ask nicely? But it's a false hope that binds us to the system. And does anybody really think it really would have been, you know, it would make that much of a difference if there was a Democrat in the White House? And those are, once again, false hopes. But there's not only false hopes, but there's real hopes, too, are problematical in that I was giving a talk a couple years ago, and somebody in the audience shouted, I was bashing hope, and somebody in the audience shouted out, what do you mean by hope? And I didn't have an answer, so I asked them for a definition. And the definition they gave me was that hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. And so, I mean, next time I get on a plane, I hope it doesn't crash. That's a hope. On the other hand, I don't hope that I eat tonight. I'm going to do it. And so if I say, I hope that coho salmon survive, what I'm doing is saying that I'm powerless. The truth is, I do not hope that coho salmon survive, because I will do whatever it takes to make sure that the dominant culture doesn't drive them extinct. And if they don't like how they're being treated, and they want to go away because of that, I will say goodbye and I will miss them. But if they don't want to go extinct, I won't allow it, because I will do whatever is necessary. And part of that is analysis to figure out where I can best use my efforts. And that's where leverage comes in, and my hope, because I can't control what happens once I say something, my hope is that my words are helping them. And if it ends up that I can better leverage my efforts elsewhere, I will shift tactics. And that's the question I ask. It's not a moral question so far as I'm concerned. It's a question of tactics, and it's a question of effectiveness, which is something we don't think about very often. Right. We as activists, we hardly ever think about actual effectiveness, because if we did, of course, we would be appalled, because we would realize that we are incredibly ineffective. And then I also want to address the question of burnout, that I actually don't get burned out myself. I don't really understand it, but, well, actually, I do understand it. I think part of the reason that so many activists get burned out is because they keep doing the same thing again and again, and they keep losing. And then they take 3 weeks off, and they go back and do the same thing again. And one of the reasons that we keep losing is because we keep playing by their rules. And the rules are set up so that we lose. It's like Lucy Parsons said, never be deceived that the rich will allow you to vote away their wealth. It's not, you know, the rules. And I learned this as a forest activist, that every time we would find a way to stop the destruction using their rules, they would change the rules every time. A salvage rider is a really good example. I was associated with probably saving, I don't know, 20,000 acres of old growth. And every one of those acres was cut within 9 months or 18 months of the salvage rider. The same thing will happen with Bush's Healthy Forest Initiative. I mean, it's the case with every abuser, that they will, abusers are relentless. And of course you're going to get burned out if you keep taking every argument that the abuser makes on face value and rebutting that argument. Because it never works. Because one of the things that we're not talking about is power. It's like, it drives me crazy. I go to some place like Bioneers or some green festival or something. The places break my heart because every time I go, there's lots of people talking about all these sort of groovy alternatives, and they talk about, you know, this particular farmer who's gone organic and he's making more money or blah, blah, blah. And they never talk about power dynamics. They never talk about what happens to that particular farmer if suddenly Walmart decides that the people who run Walmart decide that they want that guy's land. And they also never talk about psychopathology. And they never talk about the dominant culture destroying everything. They never talk about the dominant culture committing genocide against every indigenous culture it encounters. They never talk about the fact that it is driven by a death urge. And they... And so it's all just this magic fantasy stuff that if we just... It's so silly. I mean, they all think so earnestly about coming up with alternatives to the capitalist system. It's like, okay, I don't have to think very hard to come up with some alternatives. They're called the Talawa, the Yurok, the Shawnee, the Pequot, the Wiat, the... You know, Apache. I mean, there are many alternatives that already existed. I was at this conference probably 10 years ago now, and there were, one of the exercises they had us do was pretend it's 20 years from now and we've somehow gone to a sustainable way of being and people are riding bicycles around and it's all, you know, wonderful. So let's talk about what that would smell like and look like and taste like, et cetera, et cetera. And these are people who've been working on these issues for a long time, and they go around a circle and they're all talking about all these fantasies, and they get to me, and it's like, you know, it's like I just hiked up a cheek and farted or something, because, I mean, I was just ruining their little party. And I mean, I like these people, but it was driving me crazy, because first off, you're not going to have bicycles in a truly sustainable way of being, because where do you get the metal for the bicycle? To have bicycles, you have to have mining, you have to have an entire infrastructure set up to bring them to you. Any way of living that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. In fact, it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that out. And another problem was, and I said this to them, I said, I mean, you've skipped the big word somehow. How do we get there? You know, it's like, it doesn't do any good to fantasize if there's no way to get from here to there. And then the third thing that really bothers me, and I said this, is that that community would by definition not be sustainable as long as the dominant culture exists. Because what would happen, I said, if we have this wonderful sustainable community and then suddenly those in power find some resource under the land on which our community rests? We all know, everybody in this room knows what would happen to A, our community, B, us as individuals if we resist, and C, the resource. It'll be taken and we'll be killed. I mean, that's what happens. That's what this culture does. And so it's ludicrous to talk about developing sustainable alternatives when you don't talk about this culture that's killing everything. I mean, it's just crazy. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, if you wake up in the middle of the night and you see some psychopath with, you know, is holding a, you wake up in the middle of the night and some psychopath is standing over you holding a gun, and you start thinking about, well, so how can we live better lives tomorrow? Or, I mean, it makes no sense. The first order of business is to stop the psychopath from killing you and everyone you love. But that's something that we don't really talk about. And so that's another reason, I think, for the burnout is that we try so hard to avoid looking at... It takes tremendous, tremendous energy. Denial takes tremendous energy. And if you have to work really, really hard to not acknowledge the fact that this culture is killing everything, you're not going to have much energy left over. One more thing I want to say about that, having to do with the reform question, which once again, you know, if you're in that situation, yes, you know, you do whatever is appropriate, but recognize the larger reality. And there's a great book called The Nazi Doctors by Robert J. Lifton. And one of the things he talks about in there is how could these men who had taken a Hippocratic oath work inside of a concentration camp or a death camp. And what he found was that many of the doctors, he's not talking about Mengele or something, he's talking about the majority of the doctors just in there doing work. Many of them would actually do everything they could within their power to make life better for the Jews and other inmates in their care, except for questioning the larger Auschwitz reality. So they would hand someone who was in pain, they would hand them an aspirin to lick, because that's better than nothing. They would attempt to finagle stuff so people wouldn't be selected to be killed. They would do all sorts of things like that. Many of them... There were many Jews who testified on their behalf of many of them at Nuremberg trials. Not the major ones, obviously, the minor Nuremberg trials later. And because that particular doctor actually helped them. But the truth is that the doctor hadn't questioned the larger reality. And that's what so many environmentalists do and so many activists do, is we do everything we can. We do our best to do everything except question the larger reality. Question this larger reality to kill the planet. Question the rules that are set up. Who says we don't get to fight back? Who says, well, those in power say it. I wonder why. Like a friend of mine says, a lot of environmentalists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground and end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization, because once the questions start, you keep going back and back and back. But it doesn't just have to be wanting to protect a specific piece of ground. Maybe the questions start because you question the idea of working a job, of spending your life doing something you don't love. And so you start questioning the wage economy, and you start questioning, why am I supposed to give my life to someone else who has no allegiance, not to my community, but to some capitalist organization, to some ruler? And then in exchange, I'm supposed to get a few years after I'm 65. I mean, that's insane. Or let's talk about, within this culture, the gold standard studies are that 1 out of every 4 women are raped in their lifetime. Another 19% fend off rape attempts. That's 44% of all women have someone attempt to sexually assault them. And all the women I know say that those figures are really low, and that the actual number is much closer to unity. And that's using legal definitions of sexual assault. What about routine objectification? What about, a woman's worth being determined by her fuckability, based on how pleasing she looks to men? What does that do? So if you start looking at gender relations, you go back and back and back. You find yourself at much the same place. I mean, it's like Stanley Diamond wrote in his book, In Search of the Primitive, civilization originates in conquest abroad and repression at home. I mean, the denial is everywhere. At talks I do, I ask people, how many of you have had someone you love die of cancer? And it's always 70 or 80%. And cancer, of course, is a disease of civilization. It's in great measure, a result of the toxification of the entire environment. You're not going to get carcinogens in every stream without people getting cancer. And, I mean, so it's on that level. It's on the level of us having our empathies numbed. That I just read an article a couple days ago about how, I mean, I'm sure you know that with the ice cap melting in the Arctic, that polar bears who can swim 200 miles are now drowning because the ice cap has moved to 400 miles away. And I just read an article 2 or 3 days ago that said, essentially, well, that's bad news if you care about polar bears. And that's horrible. That's horrible. So, I mean, the implication in the article was that, if you're crazy enough to care about polar bears, then that's bad news. But otherwise, I hope it stops raining in New York so the Yankees and the Angels can play. And the level of denial in this culture is intense, and it's also necessary if you're to survive at all within this system. Well, it's a process. It's been a process. I mean, earlier at lunch we were talking about one of you, I don't remember who, was saying that I think it was you, were saying that you were questioning, sometimes you think that maybe sometimes, maybe you're the crazy one and the culture is just so many people think this, it must be right. Maybe I'm just crazy. And I was going to respond that I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine in about 95 or 96 saying the exact same thing to somebody who had been working on the issues for a lot longer than I, saying, I wonder sometimes, maybe I'm just crazy. Maybe I've missed things. Maybe I'm just, there's some really basic thing that I'm just missing. And that person said, I used to think that too. And so I missed the opportunity to say the same thing onto you. So it's like, yeah, there's a process we all go through. So there was a time when I thought I grew up a right-wing fundamentalist Christian, and so there was a time when I thought that the whole system's great. And then one of the first breaks for me was was listening to Bachman Turner Overdrive's song "Taking Care of Business," where they talk about getting up every morning from the alarm clock's warning, take the 8:15 in the city, and there's a whistle up above, and people pushing, people shoving, all the girls trying to look pretty. Well, if your train's on time, you can get to work by 9, start your slaving job, and get your pay. But if you ever get annoyed, look at me, I'm self-employed. I love to work at nothing all day. And that sounded great to my, like, 8th grade ears. And so that's when I started questioning, gosh, you know, maybe you don't have to get a job. Maybe there's another way to live. So it started there in some ways. But then I still went through, and I hated my degree in physics. And I wanted to retire immediately and do what I wanted to do, which was to write and to keep bees. And so that was another step in the way of, and that's another part of it too, is, you know, talking about being proactive is, you know, maybe some of it also has to do with my mom. You know, if there's something you don't like in your life, change it. And my mom just saying to me, look, if you don't want to spend your life in physics, don't spend your life in physics. It's like pretty straightforward. And I said to her, wouldn't that be a waste of my 4 years in college? And she said, would you rather waste 4 years or waste your life? And just, you know, if you want something, do it. I don't have very many regrets in my personal life because, or professional life, whatever, because if there's something going on I don't like, I generally just change it. And that doesn't mean I haven't done things that haven't been, that doesn't mean that I haven't done, there's too many negatives. I have done stupid things, and I've done things that I regret. But I don't have ongoing things in my life that I regret, because if I regret it, it's like, let's just do something else. And so on that level, it's pretty fundamental. And then so far as the culture, I mean, I tried working within the system, even though I was a bit cynical about it at the beginning. I think it takes us back to where we were at the beginning, that this is a pattern that is 6,000 years old. And you know, one of the signs, I may not be the smartest person on the planet, but one of the signs of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. And if you see that this culture has been deforesting for 6,000 years, and you think that you can stop it by simply filing a timber sale appeal, and which I did. I filed many, many, many timber sale appeals. And I'm not saying people shouldn't do that. But that was a big eye-opener for me when I worked on all those timber sale appeals and they simply changed the rules. And then I realized, there's probably something deeper going on. That it isn't about what they're saying it's about. You know, all so much of the timber, so many of the trees on the national forest are sold below cost. I mean, so actually they're losing money to destroy. And it's like, those things aren't making sense to me. Another big thing was in 1980, this is one of the things I've done in my life I'm the most ashamed of. In 1980, I voted for Ronald Reagan. And the reason, I was 19 years old, and the reason was that he had made a campaign promise that he was going to balance the budget. And I thought that was probably a good thing. So, sure, that sounds like a good thing, so I voted for him. And, of course, he didn't. And, of course, there was no accountability. And there was no mention of the fact that there was no accountability. And so I learned early on that it's really messed up that way. And it goes further back. I can go further back, too, with, you know, my father beating and raping us and me asking, you know, if his behavior isn't making him happy, why is he doing this? Him recognizing this behavior is really, really weird and destructive and self-destructive, not beneficial to anybody. And then the court system, because my father was rich, the court system favored my father routinely through the whole divorce and custody process. And so I learned early on that the system is almost entirely corrupt. I learned that that's how this system works. And so I can't say there was any moment where I don't want to say, I mean, it's really true, you know, I didn't spring full-blown from my mother's womb saying, let's bring it all down. Well, no, actually, I probably did. And then I just forgot for many years in between. But it was a very slow process of finding what doesn't work. Well, I'm going to try this. It doesn't work. Okay, I'm going to try this. It doesn't work. And then, as I said earlier, the questions, once the questions start, they just spiderweb out and out and out. And if you start asking, you know, why are people working jobs they don't love? And you keep asking the question, you're going to get to the fundamentals of this system. And if you ask yourself, how come this culture is killing the planet and so many people don't really seem to care? Well, it's a good question. I mean, I remember actually, this is a really important moment, being in a library and pulling Neil Everndon's The Natural Alien off the bookshelf just randomly and reading in there basically an attack on this culture's way of perceiving. And basically the argument that he was quoting from Ehrenfeld was, what do you do if after you make some wonderful defense of the existence of some creature, the person that you're saying it to says, well, what good is it? So the only response really is to say, well, what good are you? And the reason is not to devalue the other person or to insult the other person, but to point out the stupidity of a utilitarian worldview. And I remember standing there in the library just being, as a Canadian friend of mine would say, gobsmacked. You know, I just... It's like this huge, at that moment, this huge weight went off my shoulders, because all before then, I really had thought I was the only crazy person. And I was a crazy person. And now, and that's actually another thing I need to say, is that that's why I did my book, Listening to the Land, is because I wanted to try to find a community of people who also recognized how bad things were. So there's, you know, it's to have support. I mean, that's one of the most important things is I can't revisit Civilization is Bad 101 every time I open my mouth. I don't really have any friends. I have acquaintances. I can hang out with people. But I don't really have any close friends who don't recognize how bad things are. Because I can't go there every time. I mean, that's one reason, by the way, why I don't argue with people, is that I've heard it said that it takes 10 years to change your mind. And so I'll plant seeds, and then I'll go away. And I know it happens with me all the time, that my friends will say, you know, my friend will say, you know, have some idea, and I'll say, no, that doesn't make any sense to me. And then about 6 months later, I'll say to the same friend, God, I had this great idea. And then I'll say the same thing back to them. They said to me 6 months ago, and they're like, yeah, I think somebody told you that a while ago. And of course, I remember, but in the meantime, it takes that long to assimilate it, to understand it. So that's why I said early on that I don't think I would have hated my books in high school, because I would have thought there was this guy who's attacking this system that is a great system. In college, they would have troubled me. I wouldn't have understood them. I wouldn't have liked them, but they would have troubled me. And by the time I was 25, I was flailing around looking for something, and I would have been ready. People ask me all the time, what do you want? And what I want is very simple. What I want is to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before, and a world that has more migratory songbirds every year than the year before, a world that has less dioxin and less flame retardant in every mother's breast milk every year than the year before. I mean, that's what it means to win. Anything else is a failure. I did a talk in Missouri a couple days ago, and somebody there asked me, who are you? And it's like, there's a question I asked in one of my books, Walking on Water, of my students all the time when I was teaching writing. And it's a really hard question to answer. And so the reason I'm hesitating is because that's essentially the question, you know, who is the land base? And it's like, you know, as you see, you know, it's everyone who's here. And I wrote this piece in the book I'm doing now. Actually, I didn't write it. The stream behind my home wrote it. But it starts off, pretend you're a river, and pretend you're the mist who falls so fine, so gentle, that there's, you know, no distinction between water and air. I don't know what it is. It's much better than that. But basically, you know, I've been trying to write that for several days, and I couldn't write it. And I thought, well, this is pretty stupid for me to try to write what it's like to be a river. I should just go ask a river. And the stream behind my home gave me the answer immediately. literally within 5 seconds. And the interesting thing about that is that the whole section is, when we say what is something or who is something, it's generally the definition is by what defines them, by what sets them separate from the other, from all others. And the interesting thing about this, that particular piece, was that the definition was what it is to be a river was defined, I'm going to use that word, what it is to be a river came through in the intersections between water and not water, between wet and dry, between, I mean, we could say, okay, what is a stream? And, you know, where does it end? And you could say, well, it ends at the bank. But the truth is, all of this is damp here. And what about the water that goes up into the trees? And what about the trees who then drop their cones into the water? What about the salmon who then end up in the tips of the trees? And what about the flies who land and are eaten by the salmon? I mean, where does the river end? And rivers, if you look at them not frozen in time, but instead, if you look at them over their lifetime of thousands and tens of thousands of years, they ride like snakes all over the landscape. So where is the river? It's right here. You know, the water's right here at this second. But is this part of the river over here too? And I was talking to someone who said that, a fisheries biologist who was saying that she sees, not in places like this where you have a lot of fine sediment, but where the cobbles are all larger, that you can have someplace, she said like 60 feet away from the stream, she looked in this itty-bitty little pond and she saw some salmon. And then she looked the next day and they were gone. She thought they were eaten by a raccoon or something. And she looked again the next day and they were back. And she realized that the fish were swimming through the cobbles in the spaces in between, the tiny little fish. And so that's part of the stream too. And so what is a land base? I mean, on one level, it's, you know, it's what we see here, but it's, I mean, the land base here would include the salmon who are right now out in the ocean, because they're going to bring up, even on a scientific level, they're going to bring up nutrients. Passenger pigeons were the same. They were a huge, huge pump is what they're called, that they would carry nutrients from one place to another and then just defecate. You know, it's like the ground would be just covered with pigeon manure, and it's tremendous. One of the reasons I read that the chestnuts have had so much trouble, not only the chestnut blight, but also because passenger pigeons ate chestnuts and they would poop all over there, and that would make the soil really acidic. And so that was what the chestnuts wanted. So the land base that includes chestnuts, I mean, what about when the passenger pigeons in South America? Does that mean they're not part of the land base? So, I mean, this is a long answer that I know will never fit into your film, but what is a land base? It's everyone who's here and everyone who, a land base is the relationships that, it's the relationships that cause the trees to grow and the salmon to grow. It's all of those relationships. As I was writing Endgame, there was a place where I was writing about the possibility of humans going extinct. And that night, I had a dream that was more than a dream. It was a visitation. Just like in all the old movies where, you know, you say the demon's name and the demon then shows up in front of you. But that night, there was this dream that was more than a dream about, there were many of us rebels who were fighting against the same forces that I fight against during the day, except this time we were fighting with guns. And we were horribly outnumbered, as we are in waking reality. And we were losing badly, as we are in waking reality. And I was hiding behind this little 4-inch slip of concrete, and the bullets are flying everywhere. And then the bullets start to fly less and less and less and less, and they stop. And I look around, I look over to this fellow rebel to my right, and I said the reason he stopped shooting is because there is this demon attached to his neck, sucking out his blood and his guts. And I look across to where the cops and the military are, and I see the reason they've stopped shooting is because they've got demons attached to them too, and the demons are everywhere. And I start running, and one starts running after me, but then I lose it. And I look through this window, and I see this character who looks like Nosferatu from F.W. Murnau's movie from the 20s. And then he's the director. Anyway, I wake up, and I try to convince myself that in this dream, the vampires represented the dominant culture. No, the dream won't allow that interpretation. So, okay, so maybe they represent biotechnology or something. No. They represent demons. They don't represent anything. They are demons. They are... and they weren't malevolent. They were just eating. They were having a feed. And so that night, then that's all fine. It goes on for, just think about that in the back of my head for months. And also, I've been thinking a lot about what a lot of American Indians say, which is that animals don't go extinct, they go away. And they'll come back when the land is treated well. And so one day I was out at Yontaket, which is a few miles north here. It's a massacre site. Well, no, it's not. I was there, and the land said to me that it didn't want to be known as a massacre site, because that's just one night out of thousands and thousands and thousands of nights. That's like saying that a woman who was raped one night, it's like any time you refer to her, it's like, oh yeah, she's a rape victim. Like, the land's like, no, sorry, that's just one night. It's the center of the universe for the Talua. And I was out there one day, and the I start walking, and I see this hawk on a dead tree up ahead, and I say to myself very quietly, so if you want me to wait for the plane?
We might as well now. I was just going to check and see if... Oh, it's been way over time. Okay,
so... So I saw this hawk on this dead tree up ahead, and I said very quietly, if my interpretation is accurate, that, at some point demons are going to come and, clean up, and that's what all the animals are waiting for to come back, then why don't you take off and fly in a circle around my head? And right then the hawk took off, and it flew in a half circle over to here, and I thought, well, maybe that means I was half right. And then I look up, and there's a vulture continuing, and the vulture finishes a circle. And so this is very clear to me immediately that demons have to come in and do this destructive work, and then somebody else has to clean up. Okay, and there's a couple more things about this, which is, one of them is that we talked earlier today about the Himalayan blackberry blight. And that's one of the things that happens if you overshoot carrying capacity, is somebody comes in and fixes things up. And, maybe these aren't demons that all look like Nosferatu, but instead maybe it's a metaphor. Maybe it's a metaphor for an illness. I mean, how would an illness manifest in a dream? I mean, something that takes away your blood and guts. And so the next question I had was, why haven't they come yet? If that's true, why? It's like, what are you waiting for? How bad does it have to get? And the answer that came to me on that is, I don't know if you ever did this as a parent, but something my mom did is, when I was young, if she would tell me to clean my room and I wouldn't do it, she would eventually say, okay, so I'm giving you one last chance, and if you don't clean your room, I'm going to clean it up. And if I clean it up, you're not going to be happy, because anything on the floor I'm throwing away. And so it came clear to me that if they are waiting, what they're doing is they're giving us one last chance to see if we're redeemable. And if we clean up our own mess, great. And if we don't, then they'll do it for us, and we're not going to like it. We're not going to like it at all. I think that's... I mean, it doesn't matter whether you believe, as the Indians do, as the Indians I've spoken with do, that, animals go away and they come back. It doesn't matter whether you believe that or not. The fundamental truth is, we are, and it doesn't matter whether you believe that the demons are metaphors or real or anything else, the truth is that we have, the longer we wait to clean up this mess, the less we're going to like how it's done, if it's done for us. I think that's something that even people deeply in denial should be able to understand. And you know what? I could understand that at 6 years old. And if someone doesn't understand it, there's no reaching them. Okay, so I was talking to some people about, you know, I've talked for years about how there are 70,000 dams in this country over 6 feet tall, and there's 2 million dams total, and how dams are killing rivers. And you know, I've had that line that's one of my most famous lines. Every morning when I wake up, I ask myself whether I should write or blow up a dam, which really it gets to the question, and the question I'm getting at there is the question of symbolic versus non-symbolic victories, which is something we don't think about often enough, because we get so excited when we have some symbolic victory. It doesn't mean anything. The only thing that matters is what happens on the ground. And if this symbolic victory leads to something on the ground, that's great. But if it doesn't, then it doesn't matter. And one of the things that people would say to me often is, so, you know, if you just blow up a dam, that'll cause more damage than the dam does. And I didn't know. Some of the people who told me that were hydrologists, so I thought I should probably listen to them or something, because, of course, they're experts. So I talked to some other experts. I talked to a bunch of fisheries biologists. And I said to them, so, if a dam catastrophically fails, does that actually harm the river more than the existence of the dam? And the answer they gave me was great, which is that dams are a part of a river's life. By which they're not saying it's okay to have 2 million dams or 70,000 big dams or anything else. What they're saying is that rivers get dammed by mudslides, by ice, by lava that happens, and then the dam breaks through, and then you get a big flood. And you get big floods anyway. Floods are part of a river's lifetime. And basically, any dam failure, and every dam will fail. I mean, they will all fail eventually. That's what they do. And that's true whether it's a concrete dam or a lava dam. And when they fail, they cause a big flood. And every flood, and here's the point, every flood brings with it, every flood causes short-term habitat loss, long-term habitat gain. That's what floods do. And when they said that, it suddenly occurred to me, why do we stay in bad relationships? Because we're afraid of the short-term habitat loss for the long-term habitat gain. Why do we stay in jobs we hate? We're afraid of the short-term habitat loss for the long-term habitat gain. Why don't we bring down civilization? Because we're afraid of the short-term habitat loss for the long-term habitat gain. And that's true on so many levels. So I guess what I would say to the part of you or me that is scared about that, and I include myself, is on a personal level, yeah, it's really scary. And just to be honest, you know, you or I may not survive. And on a larger scale, it's like, yeah, that's what needs to be done. We all know what we need to do, which is that we need to dismantle everything we see around us. Well, no, not here. That's being done. Thank you very much. We need to dismantle everything about this culture. I mean, from the inside to the outside, from the top to the bottom. The problem is not simply technical. The problem is the thing you were mentioning earlier about identification. And the problem is committing. And the problem is asking, what do you want and what are you going to do? It's not that hard. I mean, what do salmon need to survive? They need, I think, 6 things, 5 of which are easily doable. 1, they need for dams to be removed. That's a technical task. We could do it. They need for industrial logging to stop. We could do it. If it was space aliens who were doing it, we would stop it. If it was Germans in occupied Russia. We would stop it. They need for industrial fishing to stop. We can do that. Boats sink. You know, it's not that hard. These are technical tasks. They need for industrial agriculture to stop because of runoff. They need for the oceans to not be murdered. And the one that may be out of control is they need for global warming not to run away. That's the only one. But what do we need to slow global warming? We need to stop the oil economy. If it was space aliens who were burning all this oil, we would know what to do. The problem is not technical. There is more to be done than what we are doing. There are dams to be removed. There are refineries to be removed. There's remediation to be done. I mean, sure, we can all work within the system too. There's plenty of work to be done within the system, and there's plenty of work to be done outside the system. There's lots more work to be done. And I include myself in this. I mean, writing books, you know, people come up to me all the time and say, "Oh my God, Derek, you're so courageous to write about this stuff." Bullshit. I mean, the real courage is actually be actualizing it. I mean, I'm not devaluing my own contribution. I'm just saying, once again, this is a confusion between symbolic and real action. Writing is by definition symbolic, and that's not good enough. That may be necessary, but not sufficient. And that's one of the things that, you know, that's one of the things that hit me a long time ago. You know, doing various forms of activism is that it wasn't good enough for me to simply make it so a couple more generations of grizzlies and Selkirk caribou and Kootenai sturgeon and coho salmon live out harried lives before they ultimately get exterminated. That's not good enough. That's not so much activism, simply, you know, it's like, yes, we were able to stop this timber sale. We were able to block the road for 2 days, and that kept them alive for 2 days. It's not good enough for me. And I've done it. I'm not saying people shouldn't do it. I mean, I've done it where you save this piece of ground for a year, and then the Forest Service puts the sale out again, so you save it for another year, and eventually it goes through. I'm not saying people shouldn't do that, and I'm not saying that's not a worthy thing to do. That's one more year. That's all that time that those creatures were able to live. But that's not good enough. I used to ask people all over the country, do you believe that this culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? And nobody ever says yes. In one of my talks, one guy raised his hand and everybody looked at him. He said, "Oh, voluntary? No, of course not." So the next question is, if you don't believe that the culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, and you care about the land where you live, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is that we don't know. And the reason we don't know, or one of the reasons we don't know, is because we don't talk about it. And one of the reasons we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope that there'll be this magical transformation on its own. And that's absurd. I mean, if you want to move something, you need to think about leverage. Well, first off, we need to think about what we want. I mean, that's the first thing. If you want to move something, where do you want to move it? Why do you want to move it? What do you want? And that's the first question. What do you want? And I've said earlier that what I want is to live in a world with more wild salmon every year than the year before. I want to live in a world that's not being killed. And, you know, we can go through a world that has more migratory songbirds, a world that doesn't have docks in every mother's breast milk, and so on and so on. And that's the first thing. The second thing is, okay, how are you going to get there? And one of the things to think about is leverage. And voting, for example, is a really short lever. And that's presuming that the elections are not, you know, I mean, once again, it's a government of occupation. But having said that, I would rather have been in Denmark in World War II than in Russia or Poland, because the governor was nicer. And so, yeah, if it's a government occupation, I would rather it was a nicer one than a not nice one. Not to say that the Danes or the Poles had a choice of voting, but the point is, sure, voting, but it's a really small lever. Or people talk about, you know, voting with your dollars, boycotting, and that's a really short lever too, in that I have, you know, $1,000 to my name, and the Walton family has billions of dollars to their name. So who has a longer lever there? And so I need to find places that I can leverage my efforts. And that's why I write, is because I'm hoping, well, we can talk about hope too, but I'm hoping that that leverages my efforts. Well, one of the smartest things that the Nazis did was they made it so that every step of the way it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. Would you rather get an ID card, or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? Want to move to a ghetto? Want to resist and possibly get killed? Want to get on a cattle car? Want to resist and possibly get killed? You want to take a shower? You want to resist and possibly get killed? But every step of the way it was in their rational best interest to not resist. Well, I'll tell you something very interesting about that, which is that the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. I think that's something we really need to keep in mind. And there's a great line by Zygmunt Bauman that he says that rational people will go quietly, meekly into a gas chamber if only you allow them to believe it's a bathroom. And that speaks to the level of denial and the level of passivity. And once again, I mean, Bauman's point by telling all that stuff about you know, every step of the way it was in their rational best interest, is that at some point you have to break away from the system, and at some point you have to stop worrying about that short-term loss for the long-term gain. And at some point, I mean, because what an abusive system will do is it will continue to wear you down and wear you down until there's nothing left. And at some point, you have to make a stand. The world is not being killed by civilization. The world is being killed by a belief. And, I mean, you know, Weyerhaeuser doesn't exist to deforest. Weyerhaeuser doesn't own any land. The government doesn't own any dams. I'm not saying dams don't exist. I'm not saying that land isn't getting deforested. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that there are dams. There is land that's being deforested. There are people who believe that Weyerhaeuser owns land, but Weyerhaeuser doesn't own land. There simply is land that we all agree that Weyerhaeuser owns. There are big pieces of concrete in the middle of rivers that we all agree are owned by PG&E or by the federal government or by some energy company. And those are all illusions. What is real is that there is concrete in the middle of the river. And there are salmon who are dying because there is concrete in the middle of the river. But we have to get to the point where we no longer believe, where we no longer equate, where we no longer believe that those corporations own those dams, that ExxonMobil owns a refinery. There is a refinery. There is all this metal tubing all over the place. But ExxonMobil doesn't exist. We pretend it exists. There is real pollution coming out of there. But it's just a bunch of machinery. What it means is depriving the rich of the ability to destroy the world. Yeah, I like that answer. That's actually the first time I've given that answer. I like that a lot. What does it mean to dismantle civilization? What it means is depriving the rich of the ability to steal from the poor and to destroy the world. I can't give a better definition than that. And if you find somebody who will argue against that definition, it's like they're not your audience anyway. I mean, that's sort of the answer for an introductory answer, is it would look like first looking at it, asking yourself what it is, asking yourself what are the parts that you especially dislike? And let's take those out first. I mean, there's no reason that you have to go after the electrical infrastructure if you happen to hate cell phones, you know? It's like, go after the cell phone towers first. Or if your pet peeve is golf, you know? It's like, go start there. And their ORVs, you know? It's like, oh, I hate ORVs. And so that would be, I mean, it's like, so you can find a place where you can start. It's almost impossible to make a moral case against taking out cell phone towers. So it could be doing, you know, taking out cell phone towers. It could be I mean, it's a lot of my American Indian friends say that the first thing that any of us need to do, actually, is decolonize our hearts and minds. And so the first thing to do is to recognize that civilization is not a good thing, but instead is this thing that's killing the planet. And to recognize, and I'm not, I mean, I like hot showers as much as the next person, but, you know, it's really stupid to put in dams to make electricity to make hot showers. That's really, really silly. And so it can mean a lot of things to different people with different skills. I mean, there's, once again, the first thing is to begin to see it clearly. And then once you begin to see it clearly, and once you begin to see the stakes for which we are currently fighting, or not fighting, as the case may be, you ask yourself, what are you going to do about it? And then you ask, what are your gifts? I mean, what are the largest and most pressing problems you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the world? And those are, you know, that's another reason, by the way, that I write instead of taking out dams, because my only D in college was in organic chemistry lab. And so, I mean, the point being, if we're going to, you don't want me mixing the chemicals that make the detonator. That's just a bad idea. And I barely know one end of a wrench from another. So it's like, and I'm really scatterbrained. So it's like, you know, we're gonna do this thing together. And then we get there and you're like, okay, Derek, we're ready for the detonator. And it's like, God damn it, I knew I forgot something. That's on the kitchen table. I'll be back in about 45 minutes. I mean, it's like, that's not my gift. And so what it would look like would be different for different people. Dismantling civilization is not a monolithic act. And there are... Another thing that keeps us tied into the system, actually, is the idea... I mean, somebody at one of my talks said, you know, you want to dismantle... This just happened a couple days ago, too. That, you know, I think it's really terrible you're talking about this. What about modern medicine? You want people to live without medicine? And... what would you say to somebody, the person said who first said this, what would you say to somebody who has some incurable disease and they need some medicine and you want to take down the whole system that's making that medicine? And one of my tragic flaws is that I can become too flip, and my response was stock up. And that answer is obviously not sufficient. And I say that as somebody who has Crohn's disease and who has this incurable disease myself and who's taking Western medicines. And it was very interesting, though, because as soon as I said that, he got really annoyed, which I don't blame him. And then somebody else in the audience, a bunch of other people responded to his thing. The first thing they said is, you know, a lot of these diseases you're talking about are diseases of civilization, diabetes, cancer, all these ones he'd listed. And so to want to take out the source of those diseases is not heartless, but instead... a good thing. Second, the one I really want to get to right now is just because Western medicine would be gone doesn't mean that medicine is gone. People didn't live sans medicine for all of our time on this planet. And the third thing somebody said is recognize, of course, that this Western medicine is one of the most toxic industries on the planet. So how weird is it that you have something that's curing your cancer or alleviating your cancer at the same time as giving somebody else cancer? And then another person said, we also have to recognize it's one of the most classist things on the planet, because this Western medicine is only available to the very rich on the world scale. And then somebody else said, you know, we have to ask ourselves, I mean, here's a real question. If somebody could give you a pill that would cure you, but you knew that taking this pill was going to give someone else cancer and give a bunch of people cancer all over the planet, was going to destroy land bases, would you take it? And if you would take it, you've just exemplified the problem of believing that your life is more important than the health of a larger community. I asked the activist Anuradha Mittal a few years ago, who used to be co-director of Food First, I asked her, would the people of India be better off if the United States economy disappeared tomorrow? And she laughed and said, of course. And the example she gave me had to do with Europe, but it's the same thing, that there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe. So there are people in India who are starving to death because of the transnational economy. And about half the people in the world do not participate in the global economy or the cash economy. And I think we can say off the top that those people, if civilization disappeared tomorrow, whatever that means, those people would be better off immediately. The subsistence farmers, the indigenous people. Off the top, half the people on the planet, immediately things get better. I think it depends on who we're talking about. The rural poor of the third world, better off immediately. I mean, you want to talk about instant land reform? Ha! Stop having guns sent in from the industrialized world. And we'll see how long the unfair ownership patterns continue. I think the rural in the first world would actually be better off, too. I want to say they'd be better off. I'm talking merely materially. The rural poor in the first world would be okay. I think the problem is going to be the people in the cities. And frankly, the poor in the cities, I feel bad about that. The rich in the cities, I don't care about, because they're the ones causing the problems in the first place. So they can all die for all I care. But I don't think it's fair or accurate to say that if civilization disappeared tomorrow, once again, whatever that means, that I don't think it would hurt. I don't think we can say it would be bad for humans in general. I think we need to be more specific. There will someday be far fewer people on the planet than there are now, and I have Crohn's disease. If all the electricity were to disappear tomorrow, I may survive and I may not. When I was 20, if I hadn't had Crohn's disease then, I would have had a better chance of surviving. I mean, I'm not saying that things won't get nasty, as much of that nastiness, by the way, will be, I would say almost all that nastiness will be caused by those in power attempting to maintain their stranglehold on everything. Because, for example, people say, oh, the world's running out of water. Bullshit. 90% of the water that's used by industrialized humans is used for agriculture and industry, which means that, you know, they say there's people who don't have water to drink. Yeah. You know why? It's because there's lima beans that are destroying the aquifer. There's, you know, irrigated fields. And if Hoover Dam or Glen Canyon were to go, or both of them were to go, and the capitalist press is still around, I can see it totally braying that, oh my gosh, what are the people going to do for water? It's like, I wouldn't want to hear a word of complaint as long as there's a single rice field in Arizona, a single orange orchard in Arizona, a single irrigated alfalfa field in Arizona, as long as there's a golf course, as long as there's a swimming pool, as long as Las Vegas exists. And so, yes, we are in the process, we are in a very painful transition. We, as those who are the exploiters, are simply entering into it. Many of the poor have been in it for a long time, and the salmon are saying, yeah, we've been in it for a while too. And nonetheless, it will continue to become so painful that those of us who are at the top of this culture's pyramid, and I include myself in this, well, even we will begin to feel it more than we already do. I don't think we should give up on reforming. And it may surprise you that I say that. But I think one of the wonderful things about everything being so messed up is that no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. And so I first learned that when I was teaching in the prison. And I knew that every day that I walked into teach the classes, I was participating in the biggest racist, oppressive gulag on the planet. And I was actually helping it to function. And at the same time, many of my students said that my classes were the only things keeping them sane. And so that's when the whole reform versus revolution question fell apart for me. That the problem I have is when someone is doing reform who then opposes revolution. Because the truth is, we need it all. If we don't have a revolution, we're dead, and so is everything else. If there's nobody holding the line while the other people, if we all just wait for the great, glorious revolution, we don't do the other work in the meantime, everything's dead anyway. It's like the women I know who work in battered women's shelters on rape crisis hotlines fully recognize that the work they're doing doesn't do a thing to stop the mudslide of violence against women. The tsunami makes it seem like it's a one-time event, though. The raging storm of men's violence against women. But they do the work anyway because they recognize they're helping this particular person. And we can say the same thing for sort of reformist environmental work, as long as they're not stopping right there. It's like this environmentalist friend of mine, John Osborne, says that one of the reasons he does the work is because as things become increasingly chaotic, he wants to make sure that someday some doors remain open. As things become increasingly chaotic, he wants to make sure that some doors remain open. So, for example, if grizzly bears are still alive in 30 years, they may still be alive in 60. If they're gone in 30, they're gone forever. And we can't predict the future. So yes, in that sense, you know, protecting this piece of ground is great. So what do you do with the fact that if you're watching this film, your hands are bloody? You know, if you're an American, you participate in this exploitation, you got blood all over your hands. But if you act to stop it, the system, you also have blood all over your hands. So what do you do with the fact that no matter what you do, because inaction doesn't protect you from moral accountability, and as much as many would like to pretend. But I finally have an answer that I'm really happy with, which is, if you believe that this culture, if you believe that humans have overshot carrying capacity, if you believe that there will someday be a crash, there will someday be far fewer people than there are on the planet. And every cell in my body wants for that transformation to be voluntary and painless. You know, vasectomy's on the house, but it's not going to happen. Okay, if you believe that someday civilization will crash, and if you believe that that crash is going to be messy, and if you believe that the... Let's start over. If you believe that there will someday be a crash, or we're in the midst of it, whatever, and if you believe that this crash is going to be messy, and if your primary concern is for the well-being of the humans who live during that crash and after, and if you don't want to muddy your spirituality and your conscience with actually taking down civilization, then instead of complaining about those of us who are actually talking about these issues, what you need to do is help prepare people for that crash. It's like, don't complain if I talk about knocking out the electrical infrastructure. Instead, what you need to do is rip up vacant parking lots for community gardens. And if you're really concerned about people of the third world are going to be worse off without civilization, then shut up and do something about it. You know, help them out so that through that transition, they will have water supplies. They will have, they will know, or third world, first world, doesn't matter. They'll know what food, what plants to eat, what plants are naturally antibiotics. So that's once again where I come back to, you know, we need it all. We need people to actually bring this down, because the longer we wait, the worse things are going to be. If somebody would have brought it down 80 years ago, there would still be salmon here for people to eat. If somebody would have brought it down 80 years ago, there would be... we wouldn't have to worry about global warming. We wouldn't have to worry about the ozone hole. We wouldn't have to worry about dioxin in every mother's breast milk. If somebody would have brought it down 200 years ago, if Tecumseh would have won, whatever that means, then there would still be passenger pigeons for the people in the East to eat. There would still be bison for the people in the Midwest to eat. And so the longer we wait, the worse things are going to be. So we need to act... We need to do this as soon as possible. The sooner the better, so far as the natural world is concerned, and so far as what those of us who live through that transition or who live into the transition and those of us who come after, the sooner the better. But if that's not the direction you want to go, well, then fine, prepare people for the crash. And we should see our work as aligned. I don't know if you know, if you have recognized this in my work, or if you know that I do this intentionally, but one of the things I'm trying to do is destroy linear thought. That's why I tell all those stories. I'm very, very intentional about that. Because linear thought is part of the problem. And that's another thing. You know, it's like, you know, being shock troops in terms of, yeah, I'll say we need to take out the dams. We need to do all this stuff. And it's like, a lot of times I feel pretty lonely and pretty scared saying all that. Because it's like, there's not many people saying that. But another thing, actually, is that makes me really happy that involves, frankly, the same amount of courage, is for me to just say openly, you know, I answered this question, I wasn't right, so I went out and I sat next to this tree I had a long relationship with, and I asked the tree, and the tree gave me the answer right away. And to just say that casually, not even making a big deal of it, but just, that's part of life. You know, I was hanging out, and I, we were talking about how one of the things I've written about lately is how love does not imply pacifism, and how I have been attacked by, in my life, by mother mice, horses, cows, hawks, eagles, chickens, geese, hummingbirds, spiders, and who knows who else, who thought I was attacking their children. And, you know, if a mother mouse will love her children enough that she will take on someone 6,000 times her size, you know, what's wrong with us? I was saying all that, and she said, well, so what you're saying is that the mothering instinct of an animal, by which she meant non-human animal, you're equating that with love? And I said, no, I'm not equating. It is love. And she said, you know, I think about that a lot. You know, sometimes I think that it seems like my dog loves me, but I just can't really tell if I'm projecting. And I didn't really have a response. That's a sort of ideological hallucination that one would expect from someone who was raised within a culture that systematically reinforces the notion that humans are superior to and separate from the rest. So that's the one thing. I mean, I think the question was what are the things that have to be unveiled, or was that a question before? So one of the things that has to be unveiled is the notion that we're not animals. That's ludicrous, and it's just wrong. Another thing that needs to be unveiled is this notion that you can, and these are all really the same notion, but this notion that you can take, that you can consume another without giving anything back. A few years ago, I was doing an interview in Spokane, Washington, and the interviewer said, you know, Indians exploited salmon too. And I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. And he said, what's the difference? And I said, well, they gave them respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. I knew that was only part of the answer, but, you know, I'm a male, so I was required by law to give an answer, even when I didn't know what it was. Anyway, that afternoon, I went up to I sat next to this tree that I had a long relationship with, and I asked it, what is the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree gave me the answer immediately, which is, if you consume the flesh of another, you now take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. So if I consume salmon from this stream, I am now responsible for the continuation of this community. And not in a stewardship way, but in a servant way. And everybody knows this. Mergansers know it. The ouzels know it. The kingfishers know it. Bears know it. And we sometimes forget. If you don't do it, then the prey that you're eating won't survive. Another thing that needs to be unveiled is that, one, obviously, is that you can exist without a land base. It's a pretty obvious one. This notion that you can systematically exploit, that you can systematically degrade the land that supports you and continue to survive. I mean, there's this really stupid notion that natural selection is based on, you know, survival of the fittest, and this, you know, life is all this competition. Natural selection is based on competition, and that there's this, you know, the meanest, most exploitative are the ones who survive. That's nonsense, and I can show that in essentially one sentence if you give me a couple semicolons. And that would be those creatures who've survived in the long run have survived in the long run. You would agree with that? Semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings. You survive in the long run by actually helping your surroundings. And as salmon do, you know, salmon feed so many different beings here. They've found, I think it's phosphorus. They've found phosphorus from salmon up in the tips of the trees, and they found that salmon streams, the streams that still have salmon, the trees will grow like 60% faster. And that's merely the trees. I mean, there's like 60 different species who eat salmon when they come up. It's a tremendous influx of nutrients. That's what it means to live somewhere. I mean, this right here is Talawa territory. This is Talawa land. And the Talawa lived here for at least 12,500 years. That's if you believe the myths of science. If you believe the myths of the Talawa, they've lived here since the beginning of time. And in either case, let's say they were only here for 12,500 years, they did that without destroying the land base. And this culture has been here for, what, 160, 170 years now? And it's trash. The salmon are almost gone. You know, I was so excited because a couple years ago I was here and I saw like 4 salmon spawning. And I've seen pictures of how it still is in some parts of Alaska. The stream should be full of fish. I mean, literally, if you step into the stream, you cannot miss a fish. And that's how things were prior to the arrival of this culture. Somebody gave me a picture like that, and I showed it to my mom. My mom said, yeah, that'll last about another 10 or 15 years. Civilization needs to be brought down now. And I've been thinking also about the whole, sort of Lakota, it's a good day to die thing. And I always sort of, the way I sort of pictured that before was, you know, sort of a grim, you know, it's like determined, oh, it's a good day to die. But I realized not very long ago that's all wrong. But instead, it's much more joyous. It's like, you know, yesterday was a really good day to make love, and it was a really good morning to wake up this morning, and I think this afternoon is actually a really good day to die. Much more, because if you don't see death the same way we see death, and if you haven't lived your life in a cage, and if instead life is one giant adventure, which includes death, you know, if death is not separate from life, but it's all just one big adventure, then suddenly it'd be like, you know, you could face down a grizzly bear and go, this is pretty fun. It's pretty scary, and I may want to run away, but you know what? This is good. And it doesn't matter whether you're facing down, you know, a debilitating disease or a grizzly bear. A grizzly bear is probably more exciting. But that, I think, is a radically different way to approach life and death. There was a great tradition among the Cheyenne dog soldiers called the picket, pin, and stake, which is, before a battle, certain of the soldiers would be, of the dog soldiers would be chosen to take, or they would choose themselves. They would get a tanned rope called a dog rope and a picket pin that's used to stake horses to the ground. And they would attach the picket pin to the sash, the dog rope that was attached to them. And then in battle, they would drive the picket stake into the ground. And that was done as a mark of resolve, because once it's driven, you can't leave until either you're dead or you're relieved by another dog soldier or the battle's over and everyone is safe. And so the question I ask these days is, well, I know for myself that I've driven my picket pin and I'm staked out and I'm not willing to give in anymore. That's why I say, coho salmon will not go extinct on my watch. It won't happen. So the question I ask people is, you know, at what point, you know, where will you drive your picket pin? Where will you stake yourself out and say, I'm not going to retreat anymore? At what point do you fight back?